thanks for coming. I do have a couple of notes, but not many. The origin of this presentation is because Bruce Tolgan basically strong-armed me into doing it. He's been asking me to do this for a while, so you blame him. But I wanted to do it before as well. Some people that know me well, I occasionally sent out emails with some weird stuff in them about things that I've been up to. And sometimes those get passed around, sometimes those get in the magazine. And usually those get in the magazine for some horrible reason, you know, something terrible happens and I comment on it, right? So, couple of disclaimers. I'm going to kind of keep this to a certain level. There are a couple of kids in the audience, including my own children, who are kind of small. So, with questions, watch the language. I work in two professions now where language can be used colorfully, shall we say. I just want to kind of keep that confined to a minimum there. If anyone has a question that they want to ask like that, feel free to talk to me afterwards. I will be here tonight for dinner and tomorrow for dinner. Also, let's try as best we can to not talk politics, if that's possible. And I have some sort of professional reasons for that because both of my jobs, I can get in a lot of trouble if I say certain things. So officially, however unofficially, I'm happy to talk about some of those things with you if you have a desire to do so. Again, offline. I have to confess that I had this grandiose idea of what I was going to do when I first started this, and life got in the way, and things. May is a very busy month when you have small children, some of you may remember, and so I didn't create the great, wonderful presentation on PowerPoint with YouTube clips and all this kind of stuff that I was going to do, and so I'm going to be kind of winging it, and I said, how should I structure this thing? I look back at my life, and I feel like it's been a series of very, very random, crazy things that have no relation to each other. And my wife said, well, do that. So, the presentation can have, a lot of crazy things that have no relation to each other. So I do want to say I will try to have a certain outline, but I have no agenda. So I don't care about stopping and starting. I don't have any point I need to get to in this presentation. So feel free to, exactly, yeah. So what I mean by that is I of course would love to answer questions. And so if anyone has any questions at any point, you don't have to wait till the end. Feel free to just ask them so everyone can hear. Yes, Bruce.
Did you go to Harvard Law School first or become a Japanese opera singer first?
Well, that's a good question. I would say, because your second part of your question is a little more specific than you intended, I would say law school was first.
Okay.
I did go to Japan first, but I was not singing then. So I went back there and sang later. So that's a sort of two-pronged question. But so how do we get here? Like most people, I think as a child, I had a desire to save the world and to be a superhero, right? Like most of us. However, unlike most of us, I sort of didn't grow out of that in some strange way, but had no fuel to get me there, shall we say, until I came here. So that's what I mean when I say Amherst and what Amherst prepared me for. So coming here, so you want to do something to save the world. Doctor, okay? Biggest thing many of us want to do when we're young teenagers, right? We see people on TV, we want to go in the ER and save somebody, right? Get here, take a couple of biochem courses here, quickly realize that is not for me. Never going to make it. Never going to make it as a physician. So think, okay, what can I do now? Well, I like Japanese. I seem to do okay in those classes, right? So why don't I do that? So I focused on that for the rest of my career here. Really enjoyed that, had a good time, did all the literature and the poetry and the music and film and all that. And then I look around and I did a wonderful fellowship. I got to teach at Doshi Shadaiyaku and had a great time. And then I'm thinking, well, but here's the thing. I hate business. and I hate economics. So if you speak Japanese and you don't want to do either one of those things, your only other option is to try to do a PhD and teach, okay? But I'm too lazy to go through that much extra school, right? So I knew I wasn't going to do that. So what can I do? Well, what's the quickest, easiest grad degree you can get? And law, right? Okay, so that's the one that you can be a basket weaving major, and some law school will probably accept you somewhere, right? So I tried that and got in, right? So then I did that, and then I think, okay, great. I can still save the world. I can be Atticus Finch, right? Like everybody wants to do when they first go into law school, right? Then, you know, you look at the first couple years' grades, and you realize, well, okay, maybe it's not so easy to do that, right? So, however, so very similar to bio and chem. So then I think, well, okay, but on the side, when I was here, one of the things I really enjoyed doing was singing in the choir and the glee club, all right? So I thought that was a lot of fun. So maybe I'll take voice lessons. So on the side, I take voice lessons when I was in law school, and after a few years, by the time I finished, I'm like, you know, this law thing isn't for me. Maybe I can be on stage and pretend to be a superhero for a couple hours a night, all right? And maybe that'll satisfy that desire. So do that for a few years. Had a lot of fun doing it. But I don't know how many people in this room ever dabbled in an artistic career of any kind, but you quickly realize that you're never going to make a living at it, right? So, you know, you can barely squeak by. And I just realized, you know, I'm a little too financially conservative to live that kind of lifestyle. So then I think, well, I better get a job, right? However, none of my background, either grad school or undergraduate, prepared me for any obvious job. So what can I do? What can I do that's the furthest thing away from singing? Military, right? So that's, you know, it's the exact opposite, right? So you spend your time with people who are, you know, doing all kinds of stuff to themselves and living this kind of wild life to the most regimented lifestyle you can possibly imagine. Went in and walked to that recruiting office in Boston, and they looked at me and they're like, wow, okay, you're like 30 years old, you know? And I said, well, what can I do? And it's like, well, you've already got a college degree, so you probably don't want to get you in the enlisted ranks. So let's see if we can find something for you. How's your eyesight? Oh, well, it's pretty bad. I'm not wearing glasses now, but I was wearing Coke bottle glasses back then. Had terrible, terrible eyesight. So I thought, okay, you can't fly. You're already over the age limit for that anyway. You can't do any of the cool stuff. Basically, you can't drive the destroyer. You can't dive the sub. You can't fly jets. You can't fly helos. You can't blow stuff up as a SEAL. You know, all the stuff people really want to do in the military, I couldn't do. I didn't qualify for that stuff. So they're like, well, I guess you could try for the JAG program. I'm like, well, I didn't work the first time. So why don't we, they said, well, there's one other one. You can do Intel, because they don't mind if you're old, okay? they're like, well, they like life experience. Like, that's actually a thing for them, right? So they consider that wisdom for some unknown reason. So I said, okay, I'll put my hat in there. And amazingly, they did take me, thankfully. And so go down, do the boot camp down in Pensacola, just like Officer and Gentleman, if you ever saw that, kind of similar to that. That's what I was expecting. It's actually not as bad as that. They've kind of dialed it down now. But the drill instructors are still there, and they are actually that mean. It's amazing. It's kind of cool. See, I came into it with like an extra 15 years on most of the guys going through there. In fact, I was older than the drill instructors. So they thought I was pretty funny doing that. And they liked to make fun of me for that. But I think some of them actually thought that was pretty cool. You know, I think that some of them were like, God, this guy's actually running with these 20-year-olds, right? and keeping up with them. So I think that was okay. I didn't feel too bad about that. But it was definitely a 5 months of my life that I did not want to repeat. That's for sure. Or as my little sister told me before I went, she said, you know, just think of it as summer camp with really mean counselors. Okay. So that's kind of the mentality I went into it. And then my, you know, someone else said, just whatever you do, I think I had a friend that was in the 82nd Airborne that was my law school buddy, and he told me, he said, just whatever you do, just don't leave, don't quit. Whatever they make you do, just do it and just keep going, right? And that was great advice, right? Because the idea for all these things, if you've ever been in the military, is they want to push you as far as they can and then a little bit more, right? And then people will either quit or they'll stay in. If they stay in, they get stronger and they're people that they can mold to whatever they think they want to do with it. So that's what I did. And then you go to a follow-on schools, things like that. And then they send you to the Intel school and you learn all this stuff. And I was telling somebody else, we talked some politics earlier about that. And it's kind of interesting about how the world has changed since the year 2000, which is when I guess I went in 99. So about 2000, I was going through that school. And just the way we looked at certain countries in the world and our relationship with them has changed amazingly since then. And I'd love to talk about that more later on with you guys individually. But so that was very enlightening. And then they gave you a choice. You know, I did okay with my scores and everything, and they gave me the top choice for wherever I wanted to go. And I said, USS Enterprise, absolutely. You know, being a Star Trek fan from my early junior high school years, that was the only place I could think of that I really wanted to be at least once, right? So I got on there, and they throw this young new ensign in, and they put me in charge of 45 kids, right? Yeah. Yes.
I don't know what the USS Enterprise is if it's not the Star Trek.
Oh no, it's an aircraft carrier.
Well,
it used to be. They since been decommissioned, but sadly, it was the very first nuclear-powered aircraft carrier and the largest and the fastest. I can say that because it's no longer in service, so I'm allowed to say that. Top speed is classified, but I will just say that there was a point where they were going along the Pacific Coast Highway and they were outrunning cars.
Wow.
In the ship. So if they fire up all 8 of those reactors, they can go pretty darn fast. So anyway, oh, come on, don't be that offended. So anyway, that was a great 2 years. It was a horrible 2 years in the sense that when you're the low man on the totem pole on a 3,000-person crew, they dump everything on you. Right, so every bad job, every little scratch, everything needs to be buffed out. You know, all the maintenance stuff they give the young ensigns to supervise that stuff. You know, the paint chipping, all the stuff that you don't see on the Navy recruiting ads. Right, the swabbing the decks, the cleaning the toilets or heads, as we call them. You know, I mean, they didn't make the officers do that, but they made the officers stand there and watch the guy do that. Right, and so you can't. that's the part that doesn't get advertised. But what is fun is being up there in the middle of the Atlantic in a hurricane, you know, on the crow's nest. You know, you get to go up as the intel officer. You're up on the level deck 12, deck 13, above the bridge, as high as you can go without being in the radar. You know, the wind's coming at you, and, you know, you're in there with the binoculars because you got to make sure nothing's out there. There's no, you know, Syrian vessel going and trying to collect on you, or Russian, or whatever it is now, I guess. Both those, probably, working together. And then, then you make your reports and stuff like that, but there is no feeling on Earth that is like having, you know, the wind in your face in a location like that, you know, where you're climbing all those steps, there's no elevator, you know, you run up there, and you're there, and whatever you see in report is what's going to help the captain make the decision on what to do with the ship, right? So that's a level of responsibility that's pretty great, and sometimes terrible. We were just getting out of the Persian Gulf on September 11th, and we were about to turn over with another ship that was coming in to take our place. Back then, we were still doing the whole Operation Southern Watch, Saddam Hussein, Iraq, no-fly zone thing. And that's a pretty standard job. We've been doing it for 12 years at the time, basically, ever since the first Gulf War. But it was kind of a pretty much wrote, nothing really happened. And then you're in there with this little room with the guys that are monitoring all the chat rooms and the media feeds and all that, and you see what happened that morning, right? And of course, the second that happens, you're getting the stuff on the chatter rooms that no one else is getting in the world, and the captain comes down and says, what's going on? And you have to be the one that breaks that news to him, right? And then he has to decide, because you don't have time to call the Pentagon, they're busy, they got attacked, right? So he's got to decide, what do I do with my ship right now to protect it, and also to turn around and take the fight to the enemy, right? Because we still had some bombs left over. So, and that's what we did, right? So that that's a moment that's seared in my memory. You know, I mean, I think every single moment of that 24-hour period is etched in my mind and will never leave, like it is for most of you, I'm sure. Everybody knows that. So we did that, ruined the rest of our port calls for that year. We were supposed to go to all kinds of cool places like South Africa and Brazil, and we never did any of that stuff after that, right? Because Saddam, and not Saddam, Osama, ruined my vacation. So, among other things. But, so we did that, came back, got a follow-on tour in Japan, and then I got tired of moving every couple of years, right? So again, restless, too restless, can't make up my mind. That's the story of my life, right? So, did a great tour in Japan, really loved it, would have liked to have gone back to Europe and stayed for a while, but I'm thinking, you know, I want to settle down. I'm however old I was back then, 35, 36, whatever it was, and I want to go back and settle down somewhere and start a family. Never going to do that if I'm moving every couple of years and I'm working all the time on a ship and being out for 8-9 months at a time. Right, so came back to Dallas, which is where I'm from, and everyone said I was crazy. They're like, you don't have a job lined up, you know, your skills aren't marketable, you know, you're old, right? So I thought, okay, well, I'm just going to go back and see how it goes. Go back, live in an extra room at my parents' house, go on unemployment for a couple months, and then I thought, well, you know, I always intended to gravitate toward a law enforcement thing because I worked with them and I liked the people that I worked with. So I decided to apply to Dallas PD, and amazingly, they accepted me. I don't know why. Again, I was amazingly not the oldest person in that academy class, but I was the oldest person to finish. Okay? So just like, again, just like before, there were a couple people that went through the sit-down part of the academy, but they didn't get through the training part of the academy. And I don't know if any of you have any background with that, if you've worked with DA's offices or anything like that or whatever, but it's a very strange training pipeline. It's probably more widely known now because there are TV shows and things like that written, you know, things written and published and documented about what the police do. I mean, we're all YouTube stars, basically, in a bad way, unfortunately. And as you know, that's politics, but we can definitely talk about that. It's a challenging job, but it most appropriately fulfills that childhood dream, right? Because you have an opportunity, and I know that if you've read a couple of things that I've written, you know about what I'm talking about. I mean, this: you get in the car, you have 8 hours or 10 hours. You're by yourself usually. Sometimes you have a partner, but usually you're by yourself, and you don't know what's going to happen. It's the most unpredictable. It's the most predictably unpredictable job there is. Right? So you can get out there, you could have a completely boring job where your hardest thing is to stay awake, you know, like many of us in this room right now or during lectures many times. You know, especially if you work the midnight shift, right? In the middle of the winter, right? And nobody's out there. And you're just like, please let there be some kind of call that I can go on, you know? Or it can be an 8 or 10 hour shift that turns into a 20-hour shift because you get a horrible call that, you know, there's a pile up on the freeway and there's cars everywhere and there's people under the cars and everything like that we can't go and talk about. And you have to stay there and block the traffic, and you have to console people, and you have to do reports, and you have to testify and write things and document all that stuff. You know, and then, you know, there's also times when you get to, you know, you get to times you ruin somebody's life sometimes by taking them to jail or taking someone they love to jail who has it coming. And there's times when you get to fulfill someone's life and help them, right? Especially if there's a kid involved, right? So there's lots of times where, there's lots of times where you have to do something that involves a parent being in trouble or something bad happening, and, you know, but there's a little six-year-old there, right? That six-year-old needs more help than the parent does, than the surviving parent, right? So you need to be able to talk to everybody, right? You have to be able to sit down. I remember there was one where my partner and I, this is when I was on training, and we got a call, and it was a mom. This is the kind of stuff, and Jonathan Sheffs, if he's here, will tell you he likes to read the police blotter. Oh, there you are. He was telling me he likes to read the police blotter for the Amherst PD, right?
Like squirrels and raccoons.
Exactly, right.
Raccoons are in the trash again.
And those kinds of calls are very, very common, even in Dallas. They just don't get answered very often because they're so low priority and we're so understaffed that you're almost never going to have a night that's slow enough that you can go to the crazy old lady's house, right, because she hears a noise outside. But if you go to that crazy old lady's house and you talk to her, you've just made her night, okay? And she can sleep well, okay? This 95-year-old lady who is worried because she doesn't know how to work her alarm, and her son lives two states away, and he hasn't called in a while, and she's lonely, right? And you go out there and you spend about 45 minutes talking to her, and now she feels good. And you feel good because you made her feel good, right? Or you get a call and a mom is worried because she's got two sons, and one of them's 14, and he's got a little bit of rebellious streak, and he's kind of not being nice to the six-year-old, right? And so you get there, and we don't know where the dad is, okay? That's another story. But you take the 16-year-old or 15-year-old aside, and you say, look, you've got to step it up, okay? You have a huge responsibility. I mean, you empower the kid who's causing the problem to give him the sense of personal responsibility and pride so that he can be, for lack of a better word, the man of the house, okay? I know that's not a PC thing to say probably these days, but in some cultures, that's what you have to say to get through to them, right? So, or it could be the woman of the house, right? I mean, it depends. But the mom's working three jobs to try to support these kids. She can't be the disciplinarian all the time. There may be some other relative there may not. This teenager is going to have to basically grow up real fast. And there's only two ways they can do that. They can grow up real fast in a gang and get killed or get in jail, or they can be a responsible person and take care of their mom, take care of their little sister or brother, right? So you've got to lay that on the line for them. And when you sit there with a kid like that and you look in their eyes and you tell them that and you're sincere, they believe it, all right? Usually. Not always. If they don't, you know pretty fast, right? And then you may have to take some other kind of action. But people think that job is that we're all oppressors. And I mean, I went to Amherst. I know what it's like here, right? In the New England area, right? We have this impression, and we're it's in the 50s, right? We're here to beat people up. We're here to oppress people. We're here to take away people's civil rights. And yes, sometimes that happens, okay? And we have a long history, and it's a varied and sometimes very negative history in this country and in many other countries. But I think things are moving in the right direction. I think they've been moving in the right direction for a while. I can tell you that, okay, I'm getting into a little politics here, sorry about that. But I can tell you that the trainers that I trained with and the people that I've worked with directly are, who I think are the future of law enforcement, are 98% of them completely on board with the way things are going properly and are trying to make a difference. They're trying to help people. They're trying to work within the law and get things done and make their societies and communities a better place, right? So if you believe that and you're on board with it and you live it, then it comes through, I think. So how did Amherst prepare me for any of this stuff, right? Okay, we got the music, we got the great Mallory Chernin Glee Club concert choir, fantastic. Professor Kallick's opera course, she let me audit that. That was fantastic. I think those early first year courses, that seminar on war, gave me a big ego crushing. Showed me that I wasn't as great as I thought I was, and I needed to really buckle down and study more and write better. You know, thank you, Professor Talman. I think same with Pritchard, also great professor here. Stanley Rabinowitz, one of my absolute favorites. Russian literature, never thought that was something that I would take. Just kind of randomly took that course. Best thing I ever did here. Again, taught me how to write really, really well about literature, and cemented my identification with the madness of Dostoevsky, who I've always identified with and just never knew. I was waiting to discover that. You know, Chekhov, of course, love of theater. That was great. All those wonderful, wonderful people and professors, and people that I know in this room, of course. Of course, the Karate Club, thank you, Bruce, which helps with going to Japan, helped me with doing Aikido in Japan, which helped me with my police work. So all that stuff, it feeds on itself, right? So you never know. I guess the short answer is you don't know what's going to come in the future. You never know now what's going to happen to you in 5 years. You never know what you're going to think of in 5 years, right? I'm a different person than I was 10 years ago, certainly than I was 30 years ago. I have a lot of perspective on the world. I have a lot of perspective on myself and what my place in the world is. A lot of that is just in the last 8 or 9 years with family. There's a lot of stuff that you think about things before you have kids, and you think about things after you have kids a very different way, right? And I know some people have told me that as well. You know, you drive differently when you're driving, right? You think about, how people look at you, right? How would this look if my kids saw me do this, right? That's different, right? I mean, I have an Amherst sticker, bumper sticker on the back of my car in my window. And I've been on the freeway. Here's a little rah-rah Amherst thing. So I'm on the freeway, and every time I think I'm going to try to do something a little bit risky, I think, oh wait, they're going to see that Amherst sticker. They're going to think Amherst people are bad drivers. I don't want Amherst to look bad, because in Texas nobody knows what Amherst is, right? So I don't want them to look that up and think, ooh, I never sit my kid there. That guy was a terrible, terrible driver, setting a bad example, right? So I think it's good to have something that keeps you honest if you need it, right? Some of us have a strong moral compass, and we don't, you know, we never have to worry about these things. But, you know, I think the biggest enemy of ethics, of ethical behavior, is laziness and complacency, right? I think you get used to a certain pattern, and you don't think there's any reason to change it unless something happens, right? So unless, you know, and then you get more and more complacent, more and more lazy, and then sooner or later you cut a corner here, you cut a corner there. And sometimes they're meaningless, but they add up, right? And that's when people start doing things that they shouldn't be doing and they get in trouble, right? So right now, I work in internal affairs, which is nothing like, it doesn't get a lot of play on TV, unless you're just like the bad guy, right? That's always after Sipowicz, you know, on NYPD Blue, you know, or the one who's, the one who's always investigating the rookies for where'd that money go? It disappeared. Now I'm going to grill you guys with the hot lamp, you know, for 5 hours. That none of that stuff happens, right? For the most part, we are there because the public needs us there, right? Because the public has no avenue to hold people accountable, other than lawsuits, of course, which they are free to do, and they do frequently. But there's also the court of public opinion, which is probably the most powerful thing there is anyway. We operate in a world where you're always one step away from getting in horrible, horrible trouble for something you either did or did not do. And I know that there's a lot of stuff out there that you can get on the internet that you will probably research or you've probably already looked at. Stuff gets passed around that is pretty much about 99% negative. And I would just ask that if please recognize that that's one perspective, and the good stuff usually doesn't get shared, unfortunately. I wish it would, but I think that there are a lot of people out there every day that are working really, really hard to try to do the right thing, and I wish that they would get a little bit more sympathy from people. But I know that you guys are all really, you're here, you're very sympathetic, you're my classmates for the most part. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. And a lot of the cop shows have a police consultant that comes in and has no cop experience or whatever. Does that ever happen?
When you say consultant, you mean on the show?
Yeah.
In the drama?
So there'll be one character that's the police officer, and the other one is a bar owner, or something that is part of the community and comes and helps out.
That would only be. I will say this. That's true for investigators, for detectives, when they need to go to a community. Mm-hmm. Here's the example. Homicide, okay? If something happens in a neighborhood, there somewhere in that neighborhood, there's a little old lady that sits on her porch that watches it, knows every single thing that happens in that neighborhood. Mm-hmm. All right? As long as you know who that person is and you befriend that person, they're going to give you whatever you need to know. Okay? They don't want that crack house in the neighborhood. They don't want, because they've got their grandkids with them, right? So there is no neighborhood that does not have good people in it. All right, and that's another thing that's important to realize. I mean, you know, on these TVs, you go to The Wire. Okay, let's take The Wire for example. Probably.
Do you approve of The Wire?
Yes, okay. That's probably in my mind, I did say that in my thing. Which cop should I say? Yeah, you probably want me to talk about him and want to talk about that. The Wire is, for my money, the best all-around police show that I've seen in terms of basic accuracy, in terms of the way the politics are played on the show, and the way that the sort of the lives of but it's also very focused. You know, it's dealing with a very specific subset of law enforcement. You know, an investigative squad. You know, it doesn't really tell you what life is like. You know, driving a car on the beat or anything like that. But it's good. It's pretty accurate. And that's because the people that consulted on that show were real Baltimore, long-time Baltimore homicide. Same guy that did Homicide, except Homicide was on network TV, so they couldn't get away with as much as HBO could get away with. But yeah, those are great shows. I'd say The Shield, great show, not accurate, but a great show.
Is this Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.?
No, that's a great show too, but that's not a police show. I do love that show. Anything Joss Whedon puts his stamp on, great. Yes.
I have a zillion questions, so I'm going to take the two that I really are most curious about, and I'm going to choose one. The first is, you seem to not have been tempted by the lure of the ladder. The idea that you're supposed to be climbing, which I think a lot of us feel somewhat, even if we also move laterally or do different things. And so I'm very curious about that. That's a very unusual stance to be so much not in that thrall of that. And then the second thing is, to go to the police thing, I do a lot of history around police work. And the thing that always gets me is is the accountability question, the resistance to accountability that gives it a sort of, a gang-like quality of no snitches.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious, does that have to be part of the culture? Is there a way around that? So you can choose either one.
Good questions. I'll do the second one first really briefly, and then I'll spend more time on the first one. So, yes, I think all organizations resist change. and resist accountability because I think they get insular. That's true in corporate America, right? That's why we got the whole Me Too thing. Look how long it took for that to happen, right? Because none of those HR departments that were all ruled by the same people that are ruled, that, you know, the CEOs and stuff. I mean, Hollywood, right? Look how long it took for that to happen.
But they don't have the force of the government behind.
They don't. They don't. But, well, government too. I mean, look at Congress, right? So, I mean, all these things are happening in all these organizations, right? So that particular problem, I mean. But, yeah, so it's, and in the military too, I'm sure that's true. I think what happens is there's a scandal, as usual, right? There's some kind of scandal, tailhook, for example, in the military is the biggest one. Now we've got this thing called Fat Leonard scandal, and you know what that is. I'll tell you more later. But it's a moral fraud, fraudulent thing with money. When stuff like that happens, some people get punished, and then training happens, right? So somebody at the top says, how did this happen? How can we fix it? And, you know, can we put the right, if they're smart, they say, can we put the right people in charge, A, make sure it doesn't happen again, and B, set a tone for the future to make some of these changes? I think in both these organizations, both law enforcement and military, the increased number of women and minorities in leadership positions is a huge thing, and I've seen it. In fact, I would say in the military, I've never worked for a more diverse organization than that. I mean, both in from at every level, boot camp, on the ship, actually in operational units, there is completely. I saw absolutely zero prejudice the 18, 19 years I've been in, right? I guess almost 20 now. You know, and that's amazing because I've worked at the lowest levels with all the, you know, the troops.
You should explain you're in the reserve now, right?
So I'm now in the reserves. Yeah, I was active duty for about 6 years, and I've been in reserves for whatever 19 minus 6 is. So that's 13, right? So, yeah, so getting on 20 years. But, so, right, and so I've seen a lot of different levels of the military. And I've really been impressed. I still think that the number of women going in is less proportionally than it could or should be. But I think that's only because of the desire to go in. I don't think it's not because there's any barrier to it. You know, now we've got, you know, female officers going through the Marine Corps officer course, infantry, they're doing the same course as the guys and the men. That's a huge deal. Ranger school they're working on. Haven't seen any SEALs yet. You know, I don't know. Submarine, I think they're thinking about that as well. The Navy's a little weirder than the other ones. I mean, Air Force has been on board for a long time, right? They don't have some of the problems that the Navy has in terms of facilities and stuff like that and tightness of space and things like that. That's the common argument that they've made in the past. But anyway, that's coming.
The psychology argument. You never wanted to move up.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Thank you for reminding me. So I actually think you're wrong. I think I have wanted to move up to an extent. I would say for me, I've done a real good job of faking indifference. Okay? So here's the thing. Here's the thing. I think, let me think. Well, here's what I would say. When I was singing, I really did try my hardest to advance. However, and I had some success locally in the Boston area, but I think I wasn't willing to go the extra mile to like get a plane ticket to Europe and like just bum around and do it there. Right? That would have been a way to kickstart a career if I really was ambitious, right? I'd gone as far as I could go where I was going. You know, I didn't want to get a new voice teacher, because I liked my voice teacher. I didn't want to quit him and find somebody that was more famous, right, that had connections, right? So those are all avenues you can take to, like, you know, to get more jobs and higher profile things and stuff like that. I wasn't willing to move to LA and wait tables to be an actor, right? I didn't want to backtrack like that. So that's more of a laziness thing, but doesn't mean I didn't want to do those. I mean, it didn't mean I didn't want success. But in the Navy, I would say I intended for it to be a career when I started. I certainly wanted to stay in 20. I had no idea what the career path was. I was just like, I don't know, I'll see what they want. If the government decides they want me, they'll take me. If they don't, they say, show me the door and I'll find something else, whatever. And I just kind of had this sort of laissez-faire attitude about my career. I just did whatever I wanted. And it just happened that I got really, really lucky in the timing of things. You know, I was on the ship when 9/11 happened, right? So I was on the team that did the planning strikes in Afghanistan, right? So if I were on, if I picked a different ship, I wouldn't have done that, right? I would have just been stuck in some dry dock somewhere, you know, managing 40 guys sweeping floors at the time, right? So that's an accident, right? What was I going to say? And in the reserves, I come back. I happen to live in Dallas-Fort Worth area. There's a huge reserve base in Fort Worth. I was able to commute there as a reservist without having to pay a lot of extra money and bounce around from different reserve units. I had really good bosses that just, for whatever reason, took a liking to me, and bosses that were going places themselves, right? So the way it works in the military, if you don't know this, is every year you get a report written about you, like a fitness report. And those are logged, and you have your whole career on one sheet of paper, basically, with numbers and stuff like that. And every boss you get ranks you against his other, if you're a lieutenant, he's got five other lieutenants, and you want to be one of six. Two of six, one of six. If you're four of six, that's not good, right? So I got lucky, right? I had bosses that valued whatever I brought to the table, and they gave me those good marks, and then I got the follow-on thing, right? They said, hey, we need someone to do this job. Sure, I'll do it. Why not? And that job happened to be some high-profile thing. I didn't know that, right? But it got recognized, right? So then I happened to go to Gitmo, which actually, let's you pull up a couple of those pictures. Just in the background, I'll just have this stuff up there. So when I was a reservist, one of the things reservists do is we get mobilized places. It's only happened once for me so far. I may get one more, I don't know, we're hoping not, but before I retire, but it could happen. So one of the things that I got mobilized to was Guantanamo, okay? So at the beginning, you know, I was like, oh, that sounds kind of weird. I've heard terrible things about that place, right? So like most of us in the media, you heard these things. But you get there and you find out, A, it's an incredibly professionally run organization. And I had a fantastic boss, Captain Mike Couts there. He's retired now, but worked for a great admiral. And so when I went out of there, they gave me this award. I was just a lieutenant at the time, still pretty junior in the reserves. But they gave me a very high mark, and when I got out, after about a year, when the selection board came up, I got a pretty good grade, and they made me a lieutenant commander, right? And then you do a couple of other jobs. It worked for a really big organization. I was the security manager for a 7th Fleet unit. That's like the Pacific Fleet. They do mostly Japan and the Far East. And I had about 150 guys, mostly senior captains and commanders, and I was in charge of all their security clearances. And I don't know if you know some of this, but if you don't have a good security clearance, your career's finished in the military, right? Especially at that high level. And so it was my job to monitor all those people and make sure they got all their stuff done on time. And I did, right? I was just doing my job, but the CO of that unit, captain, later became an admiral, liked what I did. He's like, I had no problem. This guy took care of my people, right? So he gave me a good mark, and I got promoted to commander. So that's just the way it works. You know, right now I'm a commander. So is that not ambitious? I think it's ambitious. I always wanted to stay in.
Sounds like excellence. Like you just do it well.
Well, but it's all accidental. That's the thing I'm telling you. It's not.
No, it's not.
Actually, what you're really saying is over and over again, when you had a chance to move up through conventional means, you stopped to weigh. How much do I, what is the price of that?
Yeah.
I think I want to put my efforts out elsewhere. And that is a high integrity position. And good thing you have kids, because what would you have done otherwise?
Well, and that makes a difference. Because, for example, now, right? I mean, I like I said, I'm probably close to getting out. But if I wanted to stay in, the thing to do is every couple of years, you apply for these CO positions, right? And you have a dream sheet, and if you get something on the dream sheet, that's where you go. people that want to make captain, you have to put like 40 things on there. You have to put everything. And you have to fly on your own dime. You know, I have to be willing to fly to Seattle every month from Dallas on my own dime if I want to make captain. I don't put those things on my sheet because I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to leave, you know, 4 days out of the month with all the travel time and spend that much time away from my family for that. You know, it's not that important to me, right? So I'd rather be home, you know? So that's a judgment call you make. But the thing, you know, you mentioned about doing the right thing, you take care of your bosses. Your bosses take care of you. You're not doing anything wrong. I'm saying, you know, I'm not talking about, you know, doing something bad to your boss and he, you know, hooks you up somewhere else, right? That's not good. But the most important thing is that when you get in a position of responsibility, you make sure you pay it forward, right? You take care of the people that work for you, right? So when I was the executive officer of this unit, the last one I had, that was about 65, 70 sailors, right? And, you know, it's just an example. But this is the kind of thing that all officers should be doing. And I think they do. I think most of them do it, right? We had a young lady who was an E6, which is an IS1 first class petty officer, probably the best person I've ever had work for me, ever. And she was trying to go from reserve to active duty, which is very, very difficult to do full time. And, you know, I wrote a letter of recommendation. She did this whole package. It goes to San Diego. It's all this stuff has to be evaluated, and it takes a long time. And you'll tell me when I've got a little time, right? Okay. So, you know, and it's kind of languishing. And it's like 4 months have gone by, 6 months have gone by, and she got kind of like a verbal, okay, yeah, we're accepting you, but we don't know when it's going to happen yet. And then she kind of kept checking, and it hadn't gone through, and she's sort of panicking. She's already quit her civilian job because she's not a reservist anymore. She's expecting to go full-time, right? So she's got kids. She's got a husband. They're ready to move. They want to go wherever she's going to get posted, but they can't do anything. And so I can see the frustration, and so I go to work, and I take some time off work, and I go out there with my, you know, computer, and I take a couple hours, and I start making phone calls, right? And I'm like, okay, who do I, you know, call the base? Who's the person to talk to? Oh, it's this guy. And you keep getting bounced around, right? And finally, I get the master chief. That's the highest level enlisted person you can get in the Navy, who happens to be over that program. And I have a talk with them, and I say, look, master chief, here's who I am. I'm not trying to influence you or anything. I just want to say I've got this really high class petty officer here. She did everything right. She's the best person who's ever worked for me. I just want to make sure she's being taken care of, okay? And he said, let me look. And some glitch had happened. Like it had gotten on somebody's pile, you know. He tracked it down for me because I stayed on the phone, right? And he looked and found it, and he said, okay, yes, this is a mistake. She's in. Tell her she's in. She'll get the email in a couple hours saying that, right? And that was, I mean, but that's that kind of thing happens every day. Okay? And that's in every job. In the corporate world it happens. In the military it happens. In law enforcement it happens. In academia it happens. Look at how many great students does a teacher have? And you know, if you teach first grade, you don't know which ones of those 25 kids are gonna grow up to be, you know, the next Atticus Finch, right? Or the next Jonas Salk, or somebody that's gonna do these great things. You have to put 150% of your energy into inspiring every single one of them just to make sure that you don't miss the one that has that potential, right? So, I mean, I just went to my daughter's kindergarten graduation, and the stuff that the principal said about her kindergarten teachers was totally true. I mean, she thinks that's the most important grade there is, right? You know, I mean, in terms of how you give a kid the stepping stones, you know, the ability to read properly, the ability to do basic math, right? And if they start out right, everything else builds on that, right? So in self-respect and responsibility, the Marine Corps does a great job of this too. When I was in Virginia Beach, I did a walk-around tour. I was in charge of the building for a day. We all took shifts, and I walked around with the gunnery sergeant to, like, look over his troops, right? And he was telling me, and we walked into this room, and there was this, you know, a lance corporal, which is like an E4, Three? Oh, goodness. Okay, see, I should know that. Thank you. Thank you. And a bunch of E1s, right? First-level recruits, you know, scrubbing, cleaning weapons or scrubbing floors, whatever it was they were doing. And that kid, that corporal that was in charge of them, he couldn't have been more than 21 years old tops. And he was basically managing like 16 and 17-year-old kids. And he was so professional. And the fact that they give people at that age responsible leadership positions is huge. Okay, when we bought over years ago, we had a team of, you know, from the Russian, when we were trying to mend fences with Russia long before any of this stuff happens, it's been happening lately. A Russian delegation came on board one of our aircraft carriers, I think it was the Truman at the time, and they were just taking a tour, they were launching aircraft, and the Russian team was looking around, they were all old guys, you know, they're all like 70-year-old guys, you know, generals and things like that, and they're looking around, and they saw the flight deck, and they're all like 18-year-old kids launching the planes, right? There are no adults out there. And the guy's jaws just dropped. They're like, in our country, we would never have someone that young doing a job that dangerous and that important, right? So we're doing everything right. You know, I think that's it's a huge deal. And people that I will urge you, if you are someone that is in a position of hiring, you know, please do. If you get somebody that, and I know a lot of you probably already do this. But if you get somebody that's had military experience, talk to them about that in the interview. Find out what they did, and I bet something that they did will translate into whatever that job is somehow. You may have to expand your mind a little bit. But a lot of these guys, even if they just do 4 or 5 years, that they've learned a lot. They've learned a lot. Okay? Yes, sir.
I apologize, this meanders a little bit.
No.
You talked about AMRIS preparing, basically letting you appreciate the arts and literature and liberal arts thing.
Oh yeah.
Another one of the advertisements for Amherst and other liberal arts places is teaches us how to think and approach problems differently.
Mm-hmm.
Two parts. A, you've kind of had a liberal arts career.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Poster boy, probably.
And you have spent the last almost 20 years in a career that likely doesn't have very many other liberal arts people around. Do you approach problems differently than the folks you are with, perhaps because of your Amherst background?
Good question. I will say, wow, that is a good question. Differently. I will say this, I think that it is true that statistically there probably are a lot fewer liberal arts graduates that go into that kind of career. You'd probably be surprised at how many lawyers there are that do police work for that matter. In that front, but I think because a lot of you kind of are forced to be a constitutional scholar if you work law enforcement in a sense, because you have to know search and seizure and all this kind of stuff. And if you don't, then you get in trouble, right? And then it's our problem. But wow, that's a really good question. I will say this. Yeah, because people that go to the academies, for example, they go out, they get out with a Bachelor of Science degree, and that's all that's what they get. Now, they do take history and things like that there, but the idea is that's not really what they're training them for, right? But I would say the advanced degrees they get in the military, like the leadership degrees at the Naval War College, things like that, the PhD equivalent degrees, those are much more broad. And I've seen graduates of those programs in senior leadership positions that they can see the whole picture. They can see everything and look at it from different angles. Wow, that's a really complicated question. I may have to think about that one a little bit more. But yeah, I will say that you'd also be surprised. The makeup of the reserves is different from the active duty in terms of the kinds of people that do it. I think the active duty folks are actually more diverse, oddly, than the reserves in terms of viewpoint. But I got, at least, and of course, you also realize that my narrow subspecialty is intel, which is a little bit more of a touchy-feely, weird, wishy-washy military specialty. So yeah, we had a lot of sci-fi geeks, you know, in Navy Intel, I would say in my class. We had a lot of Star Trek fans, a lot of people like that, Doctor Who, you know, people that are more into the sort of like, you know, where what is our place in the world and history and cosmos and all that. That gets discussed more in like a naval intelligence room than in like the sub driver's room, right? Or the SEALs probably don't talk like that so much. You know, I just guess. But we have other things that are much more important to talk about in their rooms. But I think that it certainly helped. Maybe the things that we're talking about in terms of kind of coming at it like finessing a career move instead of going full on, you know, obvious ambition. Maybe that is a subconscious way that liberal arts directed me to take that path. I don't know. Or is that just the person I was anyway? I really can't say. That's a good question. I really have to think about that more. If you see me tomorrow, I'll try to think about it. Yeah? You did. You did kind of stop me on that one. So how are we doing? Oh, my goodness. Okay.
So were you allowed to comment, I think in law school, if I recall, you went to law school in Cambridge, and you neglected to mention that in your background, which is interesting. You did some singing there, and I think you had a kind of prominent person who's also singing with you.
Oh. Yeah, I know you're talking about.
Are you allowed to talk about that?
I can mention his existence. I should have brought the DVD, unfortunately. But you're talking about Mr. Cruz?
Yes.
Yeah. So yeah, I went to law school with Ted Cruz. I'll keep this very generic. He seemed like a different person then. And there was an interesting incident, which, again, we can talk about afterwards if you want. That's kind of amusing. It's actually been reported on, I think, in the Boston Globe at some point. I think someone somehow made it on there, probably when he was just starting his career. But yeah, he's an odd person. I have not maintained that relationship.
Did you like him at the time?
I thought he seemed like a nice guy at the time. That good?
There you go. Get out before you say more.
Yeah, that's all I can say.
Okay.
But yeah, anyway, but as a law student, that's my perspective.
Just have one more question.
Yeah, sure, of course. I'll say it afterwards, no matter what.
So you talked at the beginning about kind of the, you know, saving the world and superhero, all that. I mean, do you feel like the military law enforcement part satisfied that, or is there really more, you know, you got to a point where you said family and all that, and priorities kind of changed, and that wasn't kind of where the goal was anymore?
Both. I would say law enforcement for sure, but, for example, I had to tailor my law enforcement career to suit the other thing. I think there are opportunities to do more direct, one-on-one good if you're right there on the front lines, you know, driving around in the car, actually getting out of the car, talking to people. There's a danger element to that as well, as I'm sure you're aware, and it's been in the news as well, and again, that's something we can talk about another time. That is not as conducive to your family. So I, you know, when I promoted to my current rank in the military, in the police, which is probably as far as I'm going to go, that's my plan.
What's your rank?
Sergeant. Okay. So I had a job that was not on the street. You know, I was approving arrest reports in jail, and then I'm doing internal affairs, things like that, and sitting behind a desk, you know, in front of the computer for the most part. Interviewing people, you know, that kind of thing, but in a pretty controlled environment, not in the field so much. But that's a lot more, it gives a lot more peace of mind to the family than what I was doing before. So yes, in a sense, I mean, we all have parts to play, and there is no, you know, there are no small parts, right? No, only small actors. There are no small jobs in an important career, only if you think of it as small, right? So, you know, the guy that rigs the parachute is the most important person on the team in the flight, you know, because You don't want that parachute has to work, mm-hmm. right? It has to open properly, right? And if you're a pilot, you make friends with those guys. You buy the donuts. You do all that stuff, right? You don't want, you cannot afford to have that guy mad at you, right? So the guy that turns the screw, right, the 18-year-old that's oiling the gear on the landing strut, right? I mean, that's who deserves your respect. If you're the guy that's going to be flying a multi-million-dollar aircraft and you may have to eject at some point, or if the landing goes wrong or whatever, you're depending on that guy. And if the organization is doing what it's doing properly, the chiefs that are over that team or the junior officers that are supervising those chiefs or that team are in there, giving those guys accolades all the time, promoting the right people, giving people leadership positions like I talked about before, right? So what that shows is if a new sailor comes in and he sees, okay, there are 10 guys here, 3 of those guys seem to be working really hard. Oh, he just got promoted. Okay? Maybe that's the kind of person I want to emulate, not this guy that's just goofing off over here, mm-hmm. right? So you want to make sure you recognize greatness, and you cannot ignore that. And if there are, as a CO, and I guess I'm prospective CO, I mean, as an XO, you step in for the CO. I've written a lot of those fitness reports I talked about for junior people. I've put a lot of people in for different awards, right? I don't do that for someone that doesn't deserve it, right? I mean, but I think there are enough people who deserve it. And you can find those people easily if you look around, right? So I think, and you just don't want to neglect anyone that's really got to come. And a lot of great people leave the military and go on to something else. And that's totally their choice, and we wish them well, and we give them a good report when they leave, so if they decide to come back, they're welcome back. If they decide to go to a recruiter somewhere else in a company, they can at least show, hey, this is what my last boss thought of me, right? And it's going to be walking on water kind of stuff. If I write an award for you, you did a great job, right? So, I mean, that's, I hope that, I hope that we've done that for everybody. Maybe just cycle through those quick pictures real quick and then we'll get out of here, I think. But I got a couple more photos. That's Guantanamo Bay with some of the two junior officers I supervised is the next picture. And then we got a couple of, got to go out on a what we call a fast boat or a swift boat, they used to call them. I know that's kind of a politically not great term anymore after that stuff, although that was a total scam. And that's in the waters. Look how blue that is.
That's a great photo.
Yeah, so those are these little patrol boats that go out in Guantanamo Bay, because as you may or may not know, we own, technically we lease Guantanamo Bay from the Cubans for like $1, some crazy small amount of money, like $10 a year or something, because we made that deal like 150 years ago.
How long is the lease?
Forever.
Okay.
Yeah. There was no end date on it. So you can look that up. And yeah, so any Breaking Bad fans or Better Call Saul fans will recognize the picture on the left. That's from Albuquerque. But I just wanted to put that in there because it's kind of silly. It's got a law enforcement tie-in, sort of, right? But yeah, so these are all, so this is, when I was mobilized, we got to go out and they said, hey, if you want to go out with us and, run the patrol, sit with the 50 cal and see if we find anything. And those guys, I mean, when they kick that thing into high gear and you're hitting those waves, it's backbreaking. I mean, you're sitting there and you're grabbing onto stuff. And it's the boat is airborne. And it's so much fun. That's exhilarating. So anyway, I really love the fact you all came here, and thank you so much for listening.